It is Tuesday, August 4th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. In the next half hour, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry visits Singapore to breathe new life into negotiations for a major Asia-Pacific trade deal as time slips away for reaching an agreement. The Yemeni conflict takes a dramatic turn with the entry of more than 1,000 Emirati ground troops. We'll hear from an analyst about why the Emirates and its Gulf allies are taking that step.
So in the wake of the Iran nuclear deal, I think this is the Emiratis and the Saudis showing that they've got some muscle to flex.
And we'll tell you about a 17-year-old hip-hop artist who's causing an internet sensation in the U.S. It's all ahead on International Edition. Asia-Pacific trade negotiators are running out of time to reach a regional trade agreement and get it ratified by the 12 governments involved. The top U.S. diplomat John Kerry was in Singapore on Tuesday to move the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP, negotiations along. Here in the United States, any agreement that's reached cannot be ratified by Congress for 90 days, double the number of legislative days that Congress has remaining in 2015. If the TPP isn't ratified by the end of 2015, President Obama may be unable to get a ratification before he leaves office next year, which is a presidential election year in which major trade deals typically are not on Congress's agenda. VOA State Department correspondent Pam Dawkins was in Singapore with Secretary Kerry and sent us this report about how he's trying to keep hope of a TPP deal alive.
At a Singapore university, Secretary of State John Kerry said trade representatives made good progress last week in Trans-Pacific Partnership negotiations in Hawaii, but they failed to reach a final deal.
As with any complex negotiation, I've watched them for years in the Senate, voted for them, may I say, for the trade agreements. There remain details to be hashed out.
He said a finalized TPP deal could raise standards in other areas.
Under this pact, every participant will have to comply with core international labor and environmental standards. Every participant will have to refrain from using underage workers, unsafe workplaces.
But analyst Greg Pauling of the Center for Strategic and International Studies says the impact of those additional benefits could be limited.
A trade deal's ability to influence human rights is around the edges. It's not a human rights agreement.
The Asia Trade Center's Deborah Elms says getting countries with competing interests on board will be a challenge.
The real challenge is you have 12 countries with very different interests. Sometimes they're aligned, but many times they're not.
The trade pact is likely to be a topic of further discussion as Kerry continues his tour of Southeast Asia with stops in Malaysia and Vietnam. Pam Dawkins, VOA News, Kuala Lumpur.
Well, the United States isn't the only party to the TPP negotiations facing a tight deadline for reaching a deal. Rajiv Biswas is an economic analyst with IHS Global Insight in Singapore. Earlier, Biswas spoke to my colleague Victor Beatty about what else needs to happen for a TPP agreement to become a reality.
There may still be time for some, you know, final deal to be pulled together, but I think it would really need to be done in the next few weeks, or at least months anyway, so that the national parliaments of the TPP members can ratify the deal either by the end of this year or early next year. So that means there's a very narrow window. One of the sticking points in the current negotiation round was on dairy, where Canada really was holding out in terms of liberalization of its dairy sector, which seems to be its holy cow, if you like, that it doesn't really want to move substantially on that, particularly given they have their own elections coming up. So I think a lot of the negotiations are also getting stalled over every country's individual election cycle. There were a few other sticking points in relation to the autos deal between Japan and North America, and also in relation to biologics. But I think some of those may be more readily resolved than the dairy dispute. So the TPP negotiations are very, very close to a final deal. Some reports from ministers indicate 98% of issues have been resolved. So they're really tantalizingly close to getting a deal. And that's why it's so important to try to get that pushed through in the next few weeks and months, so that the whole TPP initiative doesn't get scuppered by the election campaigning cycle in the U.S.
Were you surprised that there was not a breakthrough in Hawaii?
I think it was clear that there would be difficulties in some areas, but there had been high hopes that, a deal would be reached, or at least the, broad framework of a deal. So it is disappointing, I think, for many of the countries that a deal was not able to be done. Certainly, I believe that the TPP does deliver positive benefits to the member countries, and therefore it is a disappointment that it didn't go through at this time, because that would have worked relatively well in terms of the political timetable in the U.S. But now, the longer it drags on, the more difficult it will be to get through the political cycle, given the upcoming elections.
Japan's economy minister suggested that there could be another round later this month.
The key now will be the Canadian elections, because one of the issues that held up the dairy deal was that the Canadian government was concerned about its farm lobby and how that would play out in the elections. So I don't think it'll be meaningful to have another round of talks until after the Canadian election. So as soon as those are over, then there would be leeway. But the problem is that after the Canadian elections, it's not that long before the U.S. election process gets underway. So it's a very narrow time frame that we're talking about. Certainly, a deal needs to be concluded by November this year, I would say. So the last chance would be at the APEC summit in Manila in November.
And that was Rajiv Biswas, chief economist at IHS Global Insight in Singapore, speaking with International Edition's Victor Beatty. Well, it's time to get a check of what's trending on Twitter, and International Edition's G. Abby Lee is in the studio to bring us reactions to the TPP talks on social media. Hi, G.
Hi, Michael. Before the talks began, Secretary of State John Kerry tweeted, "Excited to be in Singapore for the first time as secretary, looking forward to talking trade / economic component of rebalance in Asia. Celebrating hashtag SG50. That hashtag is a brand made by the Singaporean government to celebrate the country's 50 years of independence. But as Pam and Victor said earlier, parties to the trade talks failed to come up with a comprehensive agreement so far.
Okay, well, what are some of the notable reactions on social media to the lack of a deal?
Well, as you can imagine, Michael, Beijing wasn't too disappointed about the latest development, or lack thereof, because China is not one of the 12 countries participating in negotiations for the TPP, and that is, of course, that can change, but at least for now, they're not participating. So the Chinese state-run Xinhua News Agency tweeted Monday, "The future of Trans-Pacific Free Trade Deal is called into question again after Hawaii failure." Xinhua is on Twitter at XH News.
Okay, well, what about reactions to the TPP situation from the American side?
Well, for that, let's take a look at tweets from Washington-based think tanks. It's a bit early now to expect any substantial analysis of the talks that just wrapped up, or that's still going on, actually. But ahead of the talks, both the Brookings Institute and the Council on Foreign Relations posted articles on their websites. The Brookings shared a link to the article, which emphasized the importance of the trade deal. It tweeted, "The TPP is a linchpin for the Asia rebalance." And the CFR did the same, asking in the tweet whether the TPP can launch a new era of governance for digital commerce. Michael?
Well, thank you very much for that update, G. And that was G. Abby Lee. She is on Twitter if you want to follow her, at G. Abby Lee. This is VOA.
Health news and notes. This is Living Better.
Created by an Indian physician 20 years ago, laughter yoga has been gaining followers around the world. Advocates say it has a variety of health benefits. In Manila, Filipino patients are using it to elevate their mood and energy and reduce stress. Pinoy Laughter founder Paolo Trinidad.
It changes their mindset. Instead of self-pity, it goes to resilience, it goes to empowerment. So they become very positive.
These patients, some who are battling cancer, say laughter yoga might be embarrassing at first, but force yourself to laugh and the world laughs with you.
Healing is not just yung chemotherapy and the medicines.
And that's nothing to snicker about. I'm Martin Seacrest for VOA's Living Better.
This is VOA's International Edition with me, Michael Lippin. Reports emerged on Tuesday that the United Arab Emirates has moved an armored brigade into Yemen. The move represents the largest insertion of foreign troops so far into the Yemeni conflict. My colleague Jeffrey Young spoke today to Middle East analyst Jeffrey Martini of the RAND Corporation and asked him what the latest information was on the UAE's troop deployment.
Well, right now the reporting is that there are 1,500 Emirati troops that are operating on the ground in Yemen. And so previously there had been small contingents. We don't know the size, but you would suspect maybe in the tens of Emirati and Saudi advisors for Yemeni. They're called popular committees that support the Hadi government. But this is a big influx of what's being reported as about 1,500 Emirati troops.
Reports say this is the first time that a large foreign group has entered the ground war in Yemen. Does this constitute a notable escalation of the fight on the GCC side?
I would read it as a very conscious and intentional signal to Iran. So in the wake of the Iran nuclear deal, I think this is the Emiratis and the Saudis showing that they've got some muscle to flex. They're not going to roll over when they're facing Iranian-supported groups, for example, in Yemen or in Syria. And so this is a way of showing they're going to negotiate from a position of strength. Is an escalation? I think that depends on who you consider sort of going first. That is, you know, was Iran supporting the Houthis the first move or the Emirati response? In my mind, there's kind of a tit-for-tat game going on here.
I also understand, according to reports, that the Al Anad air base, about 30 miles north of Aden, has also been captured from the Houthis and is now in GCC control. That's where the U.S. did a lot of its drone strikes. Does this mean that we might see a return of U.S. operations to that air base?
I think this is still primarily a Saudi-led coalition, and really Saudi Arabia and the Emirates are the two big players here. If there's further moves after this, I would suspect it would be the Saudis, the Emiratis, and their Yemeni allies moving on to Taaz, Lahej, Abyan, these surrounding areas. I don't think that we're going to see a robust U.S. role. We're really, on the U.S. side, we're really focused on the diplomatic front.
For the Saudis and the Gulf Cooperation Council, the GCC forces, what kind of strategy does it take to make a decisive move that drives the Houthis out? Is there anything possible?
Well, I think the underlying strategy is to establish a beachhead around Aden where they can get President Hadi back in country. And so right now he's still in exile. And the idea is this would provide, you know, a symbolic lift if they were able to get Hadi back. And that would increase their negotiating power so that when they come back to the table with the Houthis, they would be negotiating from a position of strength.
And that was Jeffrey Martini, Middle East analyst at the RAND Corporation in Washington, speaking with International Edition's Jeffrey Young. Now on to business news. The Greek stock market suffered a second day of losses on Tuesday after reopening on Monday from a five-week closure due to the country's debt crisis. I spoke earlier to International Edition's business correspondent Alexis Christophorus in our New York bureau, and I asked her how Tuesday's losses in Athens compared to the day before.
Well, things weren't nearly as ugly as on Monday, Michael. On Monday, the Greek stock market closed down more than 16% on its first day of being open after a five-week shutdown. On the second day of trading, it seems like cooler heads prevailed. At one point, stocks were down as much as 5%, but they ended the day down just 1.2%. Again, we saw bank stocks leading that decline. Some of the bank stocks were down as much as 30%, and that is the market's daily limit. Meantime, we could have seen that bounce back, that slight bounce back in Greek stocks on news coming out of the European Commission. They say they believe a deal on a third Greek bailout could indeed happen by the end of August. They seem to be targeting August 18th or 20th. That's when the country has to pay over 3 billion euros to the European Central Bank. And there was a statement from an EC spokeswoman who said that the Greek finance minister says that talks are ongoing this week. They expect those talks to conclude with a deal by the end of August. So that must have been encouraging news for investors there.
Right. And another stock market that has seen big losses recently is China's. How is that market faring?
Well, they actually saw a nice bounce back. The Shanghai Composite Index ended up nearly 4% higher because Beijing clamped down on short selling. There are some new rules that now short sellers must wait at least one day to cover their positions and pay back loans used to buy stock. It used to be that investors could cover their positions the same day, and that added to a lot of volatility. So these new rules on short selling are just the latest measure that Chinese regulators are taking to help stem a 27% drop in stocks there since mid-June.
Now, there have been concerns that the Chinese economy is slowing. How is that affecting the shares of Apple, which is one of the major U.S. Consumer electronics companies?
That's right. Well, again, it's an example of just how global our economy is. There are worries that the Chinese economy is slowing, and China is one of Apple's largest growth markets. So that's putting some pressure on the stock. We saw Apple fall to a six-month low. It was down for the fifth straight trading day. It has now fallen more than 10% below its record close of $133 a share back in February, which means Apple stock has officially entered correction territory. Aside from China, there's some concern that there's saturation out there in the market. Many developed nations already have the iPhone or the iPad, so they're looking for upgrades now as a new revenue stream or an additional revenue stream for Apple. Still, Apple stock is up 7% this year. It had been up as much as 22%, and some analysts call this recent sell-off overdone. Michael?
Thank you, Alexis Christophorus in New York.
You're welcome.
This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
As the old saying goes, what goes up must come down. And researchers say the land located beneath the Chesapeake Bay in the eastern United States is rapidly sinking, and that Washington, D.C. could drop 15 centimeters or more within the next century. Land dropping beneath the U.S. capital city could exacerbate a rise in sea level, which is forecasted due to melting ice sheets and climate change. Geologists have thought for decades that the land surrounding the Chesapeake Bay, once pushed upward by the mass of a prehistoric ice sheet, is now settling back down since the ice has long since melted. The researchers from the University of Vermont point out that their data indicates that the land around the Washington area is not sinking primarily because of human-related activities. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition with me, Michael Lippin. He's only 17, and yet American hip-hop artist Silento has a hit that is becoming inescapable on the internet. International Edition's David Byrd spoke with Border Crossing's host Larry London about the tune Watch Me and the young man who created it.
If you've been at a basketball game, a baseball game, a soccer game, a wedding, anywhere large groups of people get together, you have heard Silento's tune, Larry, Watch Me Whip. Watch me nay-nay, although I think if I whip and nay-nay, that might scare people.
There have been 90 million views of this video on YouTube so far and counting, and the song is currently number 3 on the Billboard Hot 100, number 2 on the R&B charts. This kid is hot. His real name is Ricky Hawk. He's 17. He's entering his senior year at his high school in Georgia, and he goes by Silento. And he was asked why you call yourself Silento. He said, because I'm less talk, I'm more action.
Now watch me whip. Kill it. Now watch me nay nay. Okay. Now watch me whip, whip. Watch me nay nay.
Why me do it?
Now watch me whip.
Kill it.
Watch me nay nay.
Okay.
Now watch me whip, whip. Watch me nay nay.
Can you do it?
Now watch me. Ooh, watch yeah. me. Watch me. Ooh, watch yeah. me. Watch me. Ooh, watch yeah. me. Watch me. Ooh.
Okay.
Ooh.
Oh, my goodness. Now, see, I think with a name like Hawk, you would probably want to keep that, because that's bad. That's like a bad name. That's like Avery Brooks.
Bad to the bone.
A man called Hawk. You know? Well, I mean, seriously, but so this is did he just, like, do this in his bedroom? He did some samples or some tracks or something?
Absolutely. He doesn't have an album. He's thinking about an EP. He believes in singles right now. That's what he said. It's all about singles, putting out singles. And this is his first attempt. And he's already won the Rap Artist of the Year Award at the Underground Interview Awards. And he's nominated at a Kids' Choice Award show for the R&B Hip Hop Song of the Year. So the guy's hot. You can't deny it. This song is already selling millions.
Well, that's the thing. 90 million views on YouTube. A lot of people are doing that, though.
Yes.
A lot of people are kind of bypassing the old school music industry, let's go to the record company thing, and they're just putting out their videos with their music on either like YouTube or SoundCloud or whatever. People are discovering him, and then the music execs go, hey, wait a minute, there's a 17-year-old in Georgia.
We've got something here. So the kid is popular right now, and he's doing very, very well and continues to do well. In fact, he's talking about going out on tour and thinking about that. He was on the BET Awards show recently, performed the song. So he's getting a lot of attention. He claims his influences are Usher, Mariah Carey, and Chris Brown.
All right. Well, that's good. You know, of course, if you want to hear this video, you can log on to YouTube. If you want to talk to Larry, send him a tweet. You can do that, VOA_music. Also, be sure to listen for his show, Border Crossings. That you can find on www.voanews.com.
Now I me bop, 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 bop,
to the right,
bop, bop,
to the left,
bop, bop,
to the right,
bop, I me bop.
To the left,
bop, bop,
to the right,
bop, bop,
to the left,
bop, bop,
to the right.
Now watch me whip, hey, now watch me nay nay.
Okay,
now watch me whip, whip, watch me nay nay.
Why me do it?
Now watch me whip,
kill it,
watch me nay nay.
Okay,
now watch me whip, whip, watch me nay nay.
Can you do it?
Now watch me, ooh, watch me, watch me, ooh, watch me, watch me, ooh, watch me, watch me, ooh,
okay.
I think I should check out that video as well, since everyone else seems to be online. Well, that's the end for International Edition today on The Voice of America. Your director was Tracy Carter and the engineer was Carl Starling. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. We'll catch you later.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Efforts by the coalition to defeat and degrade Daesh, or ISIL, are reaching a new level of intensity as the U.S. and Turkey have made important decisions in recent days to step up their joint action against Daesh. Most recently and most importantly, Turkey has agreed to open up Turkish bases for U.S. manned and unmanned platforms to hit Daesh targets in Syria and Iraq. Coalition countries are in discussions with Turkey on how best to clear the last stretch of Syria's border with Turkey that is controlled by Daesh. An overall view of the theater of operations makes clear that ISIL is coming under tremendous pressure from all sides. The majority of the northern Syrian border is no longer controlled by ISIL. That border area is now controlled by groups that are hostile to Daesh, including some of the Syrian Kurdish and Arab groups that have been very effective in getting Daesh off the border. These setbacks have deprived Daesh of several primary border crossings and entry points for foreign fighters and supplies. Meanwhile, in Iraq, in the Euphrates River Valley and in Anbar province, newly trained Iraqi troops are conducting operations toward retaking Ramadi and other parts of Anbar province. In Tikrit, about 100,000 people have returned to the city and its environs. Also in Anbar province, the mobilization of Sunni tribal fighters is increasing, and the Kurdish Peshmerga have retaken significant territory and continue to conduct operations that apply pressure on Daesh. The coalition still has a long way to go until achieving the goal of defeating ISIL, but good progress is being made toward the ultimate goal of degrading and ultimately defeating Daesh.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.